Okay. We've been in the last several PLCs talking about developing a diverse environmental workforce. And we started off with talking about ex-offenders, citizens, previously incarcerated citizens trying to enter the workforce, hopefully the environmental workforce. We also have talked to Oregon's tradeswomen about women in non-traditional trades entering the workforce. And today we're going to be talking about Native Americans and indigenous people. Another part of this diverse environmental workforce, it's welcoming all of the people who, and in fact, the indigenous workforce may be women and they may be ex-offenders. So it's very appropriate to do this. So before we get started, though, today we're going to have April McCoy and Linda Zender from Zender Environmental tell us about their Race JT program and some of the great work they're doing. And we'll be talking about indigenous, training indigenous people and what they're up to and some of the current events because of COVID, how they're handling this. So, but before we get started, we always talk about news from Washington. And Heather, do we have any news from Washington today?
Well, you know, this really is that quiet time, that long wait, if you will. So there's not really a ton of news from HQ at this time. But one thing that we always try to remind people every 2 weeks when we chat is just to remind everyone that National Brownfields Conference dates. So again, that is September 27th through the 30th, 2021 for National Brownfields Conference. And if you go to the website, brownfields2021.org, you can find lots of really great information. And they even have a countdown clock. So it is only 42 weeks and 4 days away, everybody, if you are anxiously waiting for the next National Brownfields Conference. It'll take place in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And again, that's September 27th through the 30th. And you can go to brownfields2021.org for more information. Now, earlier when they had different dates selected, they had done a call for ideas where you could submit your ideas to proposals for different sessions and things like that. They had the call for ideas and closed it, but now with the new dates, they actually are opening up a call for ideas again. So they will actually have a second call for ideas that will run in January to March next year, so in 2021. So if you have some ideas maybe you were thinking about that might have been a good idea for a potential session topic for the National Brownfields Conference and you just didn't have time to get it coordinated the last go around, you still have some opportunity to do that. So keep that in mind. It's something you could maybe even start working on, but keep a lookout for that. And definitely keep that in mind. So it looks like that they'll be running that January to March next year. So keep a lookout for that as well. So just remember brownfields2021.org for more information. All right, that's about all I got here on this side, Mike.
Okay. Now you can maybe tell them about our plans for all of this is tentative, both in the springtime and what we're really hoping to do face-to-face, if all goes well, at the end of September is a pre-conference.
So traditionally, we have held our all grantee meetings in August. That's a time for the EWGJT community to get together and really explore in depth all of those topics that are really relevant to us. But with that happening so close to the National Brownfields Conference, we decided that it would probably be better to hold something a little bit earlier in the year, as well as if we're doing it earlier in the year, we would stick with a virtual format. So we are looking at holding another virtual all grantee meeting in late spring, maybe something in the April or May timeframe. We're kind of still playing around with a couple of dates that we'll probably look at sending out to the EWGJT community to kind of get your guys' input on a couple of date options to see which ones look like the best potential here shortly. But we're looking at having a late spring all grantee meeting virtually. And then what we'll do is we'll actually hold a special EWJT session the day before the National Brownfields Conference. It's called an affiliate event, but it's something that's, that'll be held ideally right in Oklahoma City But something kind of special that'll let us have something a little bit more focused just for EWJT right around there, so that you guys that are coming in, we can get you guys coming into the National Brownfield Conference, can have something that's really kind of focused to our program and what we do. So it'll be something kind of fun. It'll be hopefully able to see everybody face-to-face then, fingers crossed, in September 2021. That's our hope. But that's what we're really looking at doing. And so that's kind of the game plan that we're trying to look on tentatively at this time. Again, you know, we're still just sort of in the really very beginning planning stages of anything right now. But that's sort of our really, really rough game plan that we're looking at this point. So we're very excited about those opportunities.
Kind of like what we did in Los Angeles weekend. We're going to try to pick up a day of your hotel, and we'll have an all-day meeting this time. We're still working with our planning and then within NIHS, but we'll be asking everyone for their ideas. And of course, the spring virtual conference will probably be very close to the one we had in last August. That'll be concentrating on a lot of the critical issues, because by that time, we'll have a whole new tranche of grantees that will be announced. And I'll put the schedule in the post-session notes of where we may be as far as EPA's evaluation of the FY21 grant applications. They're plodding along. As Heather said, this is a quiet period. We really don't hear anything, and then all of a sudden we'll get a note from EPA that, well, look for the new announcements to be made, and then something will come along, and it'll be announced, and we'll get it out to everyone. We're kind of right now, maybe the February time frame or so, they should be making these recommendations, and then we're on to the races after that with hopefully a whole lot of re-ups. We've got some excellent grantees out there and a lot of brand new people. So it's we're kind of looking forward to that. We're in this quiet period. We're going to have one more PLC 2 weeks from now, which will be the 16th of December. And that'll kind of be a wrap up. And then we're going to take a holiday break. And then we'll start a whole new cycle on the 13th of January. And then we'll be doing, talking about critical issues. We're going to be talking about how we get through this COVID crisis until we're all vaccinated or immune in one way or another. And then we'll lead into the announcements and actually start talking, preliminary talking about the next tranche of all grantee applications of workforce development job training applications that we think may come out next summer. So we'll be doing the cycle again and getting ready for the new competitive application process. So just to give you an idea of what's coming up in the next 6 or 8 months, that's the kind of where we're going at this point. Of course, in between now and then, we've got some special things going on. We're going to probably be asking you about what you're doing in this era of COVID. We'd like to get an update from everybody, what they're doing, how they're doing it, how they're getting along. And of course, we'll have some PLCs about that. And we'll hear from Zender today of how they're handling it. We'd like to get an idea and exchange ideas of what everyone else is doing, where they're at and how they're handling this. And then, of course, updating our social media and our course offerings. So we'll be doing that in the winter part of this year. Today, as I said, we're fitting in a crucial piece. We're going to be the Connect issue this month is going to be talking about diversity in the workforce. And we in that issue, we're just starting the discussion, and it really is just the start of diversity in the workforce. We have grantees that are training very specifically, for example, Oregon tradeswomen, bringing women in non-traditional trades. We've got people like Cypress Mandela, who may have 50 or 60%. I believe Zender will indicate they have a large cohort of women. We also have amongst all of our grantees a certain number of ex-offenders, people trying to reenter the environmental workforce. And we've got quite a few grantees who are working with Indigenous people, Native Americans. And while some are doing more than others, we like to hear from those who are doing a lot of that type of training. We talked to Recycle Force regarding reentry. We talked to Oregon Tradeswomen regarding females in the workforce. And today we're going to talk about Zender, who has done an incredible job, over 5 grants starting in 2011. And we have received and re-upped every, on a regular basis, 5 environmental workforce development job training grants. And they will, there's no accident that they're receiving, competing, and getting these grants. They have a program called the Rural Alaska Community Environmental Job Training Program, which I'm sure Lynn and April talked about, Race JT. Before I turn it over to them, though, when we're done with this conversation, I hope everyone will go to their website. Their website, I would say, is the best, the absolute best website of any of our grantees. It is fantastic. Anything you want to know about what they're doing up there and more, and the courses they offer, how you get into the program, recruiting, signing up for the program. I mean, it is all there, and it's fantastic. I have to give kudos to April and Lynn. You've done and maintained an excellent website. And with that, I'm just going to turn it over to whichever one of you would like to start.
Great. Thanks, Mike. This is Lynn. I'm the director here at Zender Environmental, and I work with April as the program manager of RaceJet. This is a real brief overview of our program. It's pretty unusual. The setup in Alaska is that there are about 200 off-road communities, meaning that you need to fly, take a jet to a regional hub, and then take a small plane over to those communities. So they're only accessible by plane, and then they're served by a commercial barge one to a few times during the summer, as it's sort of typical. Our program targets people who want to learn job skills and stay within their communities. We're really trying to, I guess, go against the sort of brain drain that can often happen in situations, you know, such as Alaska. So that people who really want to stay and are involved in supporting their community. There are not a lot of jobs. Most of those villages are, you know, a couple hundred people, large village, maybe 1,000 people. They are primarily, say, about 95% Alaska Native. There's not that they're quite poor. So about a third of the median household income of the state is average. So our program, we want to make sure that each community, because they are independent, and they may be 1 to 2 days to a bad, if it's a bad extreme weather, maybe even a week away from emergency response crews that may come from, you know, Anchorage or Fairbanks. They need to be those first responders. These communities all need to operate their own landfill, not a transfer station, a full landfill. Each village has to base is a nation in some ways because they're tribes, but also they're essentially operating sort of everything there. So what happens is we need to train our environmental technicians for sort of a range of jobs, and primary among that too is the landfill and emergency response. So that's what we train for. What we do is we take 18 people. We take 18 people from rural Alaska villages, so we'll end up with maybe folks from, say, anywhere between 12 to 15 villages, because we'll sometimes we'll have multiples, and we'll take them into Anchorage because it's cheaper, because the instructors are all here, and we'll fly them all in, all expenses paid, from all throughout Alaska, and they'll be here for 2 weeks on, then 2 weeks off to get back home to their communities, and 2 weeks on again. So we're actually an in-residence style program on a typical year. Last year we did it all virtually, not by Zoom, but by phone and mailed materials. And at the end, what people end up with is about 15 different certificates, including 10 University of Alaska credits. It's a really great program. We do a lot of team building and skill building. Again, these guys are with guys and girls are with women are with each other 24 hours a day, as are we. So there's a lot of opportunity for that. We treat the program like it's a job, basically. And it's intensive because it's very expensive to house people. And also there's a lot of different jobs, you know, for example, subsistence and feeding their families and basketball coaching and everything else that they need to do back home. So they can't afford to be away from home. So we are typically doing 10 to 12 hour days every day, 7 days a week, for a total of about 28 or 29 days all told. So that's our program. Our success rate's great. I mean, we've served so far 69 villages, communities where we have graduates in. We have a 97% job placement rate, and our retention rate is 85%. So those are numbers that we're super proud of, and they work really, really hard. But it's just a great it's a great experience. And I know everyone here that runs a job training program, you know, shares that the pride that we see with our graduates. So April and I decided we wanted to just kind of more open it up to questions. I know we only have 12 minutes and counting. We wanted to talk about diversity. And I know, did anyone have any particular questions? I know Mike had included several bullets. If there's any of those bullets that are of particular interest, we can speak to that. Any questions? Okay, well, if not, then you're going to just hear April and I give our own feedback on some of the issues that come up with working with a diverse
The question I have is the elephant in the room, which is COVID, and how have you dealt with COVID and, you know, the flying, and are you replacing that with virtual, or what's your thinking?
Yeah, so we did this last year, so our communities are all considered high risk because there are no primary medical facilities. There's simply a clinic with health aides that have about a 10-week training. So then they need to fly a small plane to a regional hospital, and if it becomes critical, they have to fly another jet to Anchorage. And there's a number of other high-risk issues related to that. So we cannot, period, have any flying in between. Those communities are shut down. Most of them are, a lot of them are in quarantine now. So it's quite serious. So we actually have a pretty different situation than other people. So not only that, but the broadband, rural broadband, I know is an issue in, you know, really remote and rural areas in the lower 48. It's quite bad. So our folks, many of them didn't have access even to the tribal office internet, and that is slow, like quite slow. So we ended up having to do it by phone and then sending materials by post. And it was laborious, and it was done on the fly because we had to cancel all our trips, all our flights, so it kind of sprung right at the wrong time. So I don't know how applicable what we did is to other programs, because most programs I know, you know, are able to use sort of a Zoom-like feature, and we can't.
So you could use like this conferencecall.com or whatever, and then it's almost like a correspondence course. Is that
old-time correspondence course? Exactly. I've had several people who have done that and have said, "Wow, that's just like I used to do that, at, you know, 50 years ago." Yep.
Wow.
Well, hi. I just got on. This is Buddy. I just got on. I wasn't aware that we were talking to someone from Alaska in a rural setting like this. You need to be commended for the work that you're doing. This is, I mean, we have to worry about a little bit of rain and a little bit of snow every now and then, but to have that kind of a working environment, how do you train individuals, and what type of work do you guys do there in Alaska? I'm mesmerized about this, because this is just, when you look at the challenges that you all must face in that kind of an environment, it just seems to me, wow, I'm mesmerized. Didn't realize I was getting on this kind of a conversation.
Well, did you want to take that in? I know it's a kind of a broad question, and then I did want to speak to a little bit about some perspectives I had on the diversity piece as well. So, I don't know. April? Are you there?
Sure. I can offer that in a typical, normal scenario, we are able to see people face-to-face. Like Lynn said, people fly in. Our trainings are grant funded. So they're able to focus, you know, on the training while they're here. But the challenges now that people are not able to travel are the bandwidth Lynn was talking about. RaceJet and all of our trainings are now, until safe, we are doing them just via live calls, because that's, how people can join. For RaceJet, lots of folks, that audience, do not even have devices they can receive materials on. So those are other considerations that we are doing now for COVID. But Lynn, I'll let you go ahead and talk about the diversity.
And to Betty's question, just real briefly too, I mean, as April said, so we bring people into Anchorage, but we all of our courses and training is geared specifically to rural Alaska situations and circumstances, it's a difference. So, if we're teaching solid waste, it's not about transfer stations or getting in a big truck. It's about, snow machines and ATVs and unlined dump sites and no, water, electricity kind of thing. Your recycling center is going to be a shipping van. So those types of things, we make it really sort of more applicable to that piece. All our in-house staff are traveled quite a bit in rural Alaska, and that's pretty much, who we train and work with and provide technical assistance, in general. That's a really important piece. And then the contracted out classes, like Hazwoper 40, our instructors are familiar with rural Alaska, which gets, and so we train for almost like a jack of all trades environmental tech, because these are such small communities that, first of all, they need to know how to do almost everything, because there's not a lot of, people there, and it's not easy to sort of order out or order in someone to do something because they have to fly in and fly out. And then, you know, sort of cobbling together part-time jobs that, you know, where in a larger community it might be that, you know, you have a full-time landfill operator, you have a full-time, you know, emergency response, you know, safety person, you have a full-time this. So these are the people that kind of, the people that we're training, they're basically going to be sort of all these jobs.
Yeah, they have become the experts. Do your graduates go back to their, now, are they home tribe? Would you call them home tribes or home communities? Is each town a tribe?
Yeah, so each village has a tribe. They will often also have a municipality, a city government, but it's the same people. So, you know, the community is primarily tribal members. There are two operating governments there, if or when it's either just a tribal government or a tribal and city government. And yeah, so we specifically recruit people who are interested in staying in their communities. They don't always get job placements in their communities. It's really difficult. We work with the community in a variety of different ways to make sure that they are able to get work there or increase their wages. But if they don't, then we try to work to get them a job in the region, and then sometimes they'll work on the slope, you know, occasionally Anchorage. But, you know, we really look for people that want to go back to their communities and stay there.
So you've almost got a reverse recruitment where you've got someone in a community or a tribe, and they want to get educated, so the job opening may be there before they even go into your program, it sounds like.
We look for people who we give extra points to people who, you know, the employer, the tribe, the city, a project contractor, you know, would be able to hire them if they had the correct certificates to do so. So that really helps us do that. Yeah. So, and then, you know, in sort of just real briefly, since to speak about diversity in the next minute and a half, is that, you know, one of the things that we really, so our students are, you know, pretty much, I don't know, say 17 Alaska Natives and one non-Alaska Native, you know, on an average basis. The issue for them, so the communities that they come from, they are traditional communities, and the life ways that are there are very, very different, you know, from Anchorage. So we do spend a lot of time working with sort of what we offer a job readiness skill, which is not paid for by the EPA, but a piece of this one is that we work with instructors who have not worked with this population before to make sure that they understand, you know, where our students are coming from and some of the different sort of ways, general ways of communicating. We do have people who come in with English as a second language. There are communities that still speak Yupik as a first language. So we kind of work with instructors in that way. And we also address issues like discrimination, because in Anchorage, that is a fact. It's fairly systemic.
Is there one language? Yeah. I'm sorry for interrupting you. Is there a universal language among Native Alaskans?
No.
Yeah.
But
wow.
In general, the people that come into the program that are first language are, it's Yupik. The Western Alaska the communities where the children are still speaking their language as a first language, and if you went there, everyone would be speaking Yupik. The only reason they would be speaking English is because you're there. Those communities tend to be Yupik. So there are exceptions, but in general, you know, when we're looking at as a second language, now we get a lot of older people too. So when you get the older folks in, you could be getting English as a second language from a number of other different language groups. Regardless, we do have a staff member who speaks Yupik. So we're generally pretty cognizant of when we have, people. If you're from a community that's Yupik as a first language, and you're generally someone that has not been in the workforce much, then you're not going to have that much experience speaking English. You understand it. We're not so, but any of us who know second language, it takes a lot to translate.
Well, not
only
that,
language. It's not a romantic
not
language.
Only,
it's
when we talk about business. A diversified workforce, we talk about a diversified workforce. They probably haven't been in the classroom for decades, some of them, I would think.
Well, when we talk about the older students, if they're 55, 60, of course they haven't been in a classroom since, most of them are, high school graduates, so since 18. It's not any really different from any other population in that sense, but our older students, we will get, a number that aren't very good with computers because the last time they were in the classroom, they didn't really have computers.
Do you find many females applying for your program?
We have, compared to the general population that is interested in the type of work that we train for, we have a really good representation. But that's anywhere from like a quarter to a third of our class will be female.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Interesting. Do you have problems with the chiefs? One of the problems that some of our grantees who work with Native American, with tribes in the continental United States, say they have sometimes issues with the management or the tribal leaders. In your case, are those the kind of conflicts, or do you find that everyone is very receptive to what you're doing, or you have to kind of convince them that what you're doing is in their best interest, or?
I can take that unless you want to.
I would just start it off by saying, I think you can answer this, Lynn, better than I, but I would start it off by saying we, have, been building these relationships and, trust.
Have you had leaders who have said, well, we don't want to work with this other group, or they're very skeptical about your training, or have you found that they're pretty receptive?
So the way we operate our program, and so typically, so first of all, I know you've used the word chief, so there's a number of cultures in Alaska, so there's Indian cultures like Athabasca and Tlingit, Tsimshian, Haida, and then the Yupik and Inupiat and Siberian, larger kind of groups, and those don't have chiefs. But the tribal leaders, well, we recruit individuals from the communities. So we're not working necessarily directly with the tribe or the city government. But what we do ask those individuals is, are you able to get a job? The primary employer in these communities is going to be the tribe or the city, and those are going to be through every community has a post office and a school, a landfill, a water wastewater treatment plant, an electrical plant, and nothing else. So there are no hotels or restaurants or anything like that. So often, where we're dealing with that tribe is either the GAP program person is a really good contact to get a hold of the people that are applying, because often their communications equipment may not be that great, but they don't have a direct say in sort of what we're doing. They may, if they are the entity where this individual says they're going to get a job, then we will be in direct contact with them. But we, as Vendor Environmental, we do have a really good reputation, and you know, we have, we're sort of well networked throughout the state, so we will often know people already in that community, and if not, then we know someone who knows someone. So we rarely come across that issue, but as April said, it is really important to have that trust relationship.
Yeah.
It is very, you know, it's really valuable to, I think.
Now, one of the things about tribes, some Native American populations is, I don't know if so much drugs, but alcohol. Do you have a substance abuse issue, or how do you handle that? You know, everyone's handling it differently now because in many states there's nothing illegal about any of that. Sometimes employers won't hire people who can't pass a drug test or have alcohol issues. How do you all feel? Everyone's different now. Some are not even testing as they come in, you know, and some.
So we're in residence program, so we might be handling it differently other ways. Alaska, just as a state, has a high alcoholism rate. In rural Alaska, there's an even higher prevalence of unfortunate alcoholism. And it has nothing to do, obviously, with, you know, whether people are Alaska Native, but rural Alaska is pretty, there's a lot of different difficult situations people are dealing with. So there's a high prevalence of alcoholism. And our initial program, we had a more tolerant sort of situation where we thought, okay, just that... you know, don't, you're not allowed to come to class under the influence. That's really difficult for us to say that is because we're not experts in that. But what happened was it really backfired in that we had several people who had been sober for quite a while and, you know, went, unfortunately, because everyone's so close, they've got it, they're with a roommate, there's nothing to do, you know, these are not fancy hotel rooms we're sticking people with, and there's, you know, nothing to do. It's a really high-stress environment, and most of the villages are dry. So it's more difficult to obtain alcohol, and it's quite expensive. So if you're someone with an alcohol use problem, it is extremely difficult to come to Anchorage where the alcohol is cheaper, more available, and you're in a high-stress situation. And we decided that we didn't want to place people in that position, nor ourselves, in terms of trying to decide who was under the influence and who wasn't. So we have a zero tolerance program. We make it really clear. We stress it from the initial get-go. We that's a big piece of our retention piece, too, is building that sort of outlook and buddy-buddy system so that the chances are, because it's prevalent in rural Alaska, that we will get a number of recovering alcoholics in our program. And so we want to make sure that we're, you know, providing an atmosphere that's supportive. And we put a lot of effort into that, you know, particularly April puts a lot of effort into that. We invite sort of mentors and a number of different efforts, but
And this is April, and I will add to that that we do, when it's in person and folks are in, we require them to, we let them know that there will be drug testing or alcohol, you know, a breathalyzer, and we let them know, you know, and it's helped. And we let people from the know from the very beginning that that's the case. And so they know, you know, from the very beginning, like Lynn said, how to make the best decision for themselves, whether the program is, you know, for them at this time. During, you know, this last cohort, I will say doing virtual trainings, it's a little more difficult to administer a breathalyzer. But, you know, our cohort this last 2020 committed, and they were great. They attended every training, and they did complete.
Yeah, and I would also say that our alcohol and substance abuse policies, because we also include pot with that, it's built on our participants' feedback. It's not us kind of deciding, oh, well, we're going to do this, this, and this. You know, we, you know, from early on in the days, you know, have, you know, those are the feedback we got from participants, you know, try random breathalyzer, you know, and we don't test everyone every day. It's more if, you know, someone comes in late or something, and, you know, occasionally we'll say, you know, random, but it I think, you know, really helping people, those few individuals particularly that, you know, may have a really, you know, it's a, they're, you know, this is their second, third, fourth, fifth chance, and we want them to succeed, and most of them do, and it's just phenomenal when that happens. So, but it's, you know, we're depending on all the feedback from all the other years to build what we have today, and what's going to be most effective for people that have actually gone through the program.
Exactly, exactly. The students themselves, you know, recommended this to us, and it's been effective. We also set up a very strong and encourage a strong buddy system so that people are connecting with each other and helping to support each other in that. We are definitely asking them to treat this like a job because, you know, this is how it will be on their job. They could, you know, these are our standards that they will need to recognize and understand and adhere to.
The other piece there that this comes back to the diversity topic is that from the first day, we have to spend a day, the first day, and it's, we talk about cultural values that we have, you know, the wider sort of breakdowns of language, cultural groups, and each of these have sort of cultural values. Many of them have, you know, values in common, but we build our rules from those values and sort of integrate that to kind of more and have students kind of come up with that sort of same sense of like, okay, this is what this rule is. This is how this relates to what's actual value to be. So we're, you know, we really try to integrate that sort of Western oriented, you should not do this, don't do this, don't do this, but more of the piece of, but respect for people and the sort of positive piece of that, you know, living.
Your strategies are obviously working. When I remember when this program started and EPA was concerned, the hardest environmental workforce projects are rural, tribal or indigenous people, issues with ethnicity, with regard to language. Everything that you have ranks in the hardest to be successful job training grantee, and you've done it. And so it's I have to say it's very impressive. It really is. And
I do want to just add that, I mean, our participants and the communities they come from, I mean, the cultural values that they do have and their willingness and, you know, passion and, you know, desire to go back to those communities and help them, that's what really drives the program and our success. We're sort of there trying to, like, follow their lead, you know, if that makes sense. So
mm-hmm. Well, you must have a good recruiting program.
Yeah. We just, yeah.
You got motivated students.
Motivated students and motivated communities. Students that are really attached to their communities, their ways of life, and helping their communities be able to continue to, you know, live subsistence ways of life and be able to protect that and protect their community and, you know, feel, you know, pride in that, you know, within their skills to be able to do that. And that's really what drives the success of our program, not I don't know. That's what I think, April.
Well, you know, you couldn't get any more diverse. I mean, you've got women. You've got, I'm sure you've got previously incarcerated people. You've got women. You've got ethnicity, diversity. I mean, you've got age diversity. So you're really hitting all the shots right there.
Not at all.
they do. They have it all, which is very impressive. Anyone have any additional questions? Is it okay, Lynn and April, if I put your contact information in there? What I would also really like to do is encourage people to visit your website, if it's all right with you. This is, as I said in the beginning of this conversation, this is probably the best website of any of our grantees. And I would encourage people to just take a trip over there and just go through all of the pages in there, and you'll be impressed. Everything from how to apply to content, different pollutants, and what they're doing. I mean, it is you put a lot of thought into that, which probably responds to your answer of being so rural. It's not like you could have orientation nights or anything that other people have. Well,
yeah, and I will say both April and I, we really like, you know, we love the job training, you know, sort of network, and, you know, we feed off ideas from other people, and I'm more than willing to, you know, help anyone, you know, who might see any similarities and what they're dealing with and what we deal with and, you know, talking about stuff. So, yeah.
One last question I have is, do you your own training, or do you get consultants, or they've got to be very tolerant people and fit in your culture?
It's a combination. And like I say, when we do contact people, they're ones that are familiar with rural Alaska, right, April? Wouldn't you say?
Yes, correct. And any new instructors we might have coming in, we, you know, we offer meetings and fact sheets and any information we can to, you know, help them get acquainted with their audience. But I will say, I do want to say the all grantee meetings are fabulous and crucial in our development as well. We've learned so much from all of you. You know, chatting with you and your programs are amazing, and it's a great collaboration.
Great. Any other questions? This has been a great and an interesting experience for those of us who have never been in Alaska, let alone rural Alaska.
I have a comment, if I may. Hi, everybody. This is Angelo Lampus. I'm calling from New York City. I'm a professor here at City College of New York. All of this was very inspirational. I agree with everybody. I have been to Alaska once in 2015 on a research project, collecting geophysics up in the, don't remember the location anymore, but we drove 400 miles north of Fairbanks, close to the Arctic Ocean over there. And one thing I would like to say as a suggestion, perhaps as an additional revenue for the graduates, is that people like me and other scientists, I didn't know that there's all of this streaming of scientists going up and down Alaska, you know, for data collections. So I was, I'm sorry for the noise. I have some of my kids here I'm having online teaching right now. So I want to say that people like me coming from the city looking for some assistance in the field, it's in a different side of the environmental, obviously. It has to do with data collections. But that would have been very helpful to have some local contacts like this. And, you know, just a suggestion. I'm sorry for the background noise. That's all I had. Thank you, and congratulations again.
Could you give we're going to put it in the post-session notes. I'm not sure everyone's getting post-session notes. So can April or Lynn give their email address so that anyone who's not getting post-session notes could get in touch with you? I'll put it in the post-session notes. But
Oh, you mean right now?
Yes.
Sure. So this is Lynn. And my email is lzender, L-Z-E-N-D-E-R, at zendergroup, zendergroup.org.
Okay, great. And,
mine is a McCoy at zendergroup.org.
M-C-C-O-Y. Okay. Heather, could you give your address for those who are not on the PLC list? In case we have someone who may want to get the notes and know people who are going to Alaska and may want to touch base with Zender.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you don't get the PLC notes, Mike sends those out specifically on Friday. There's more information than what we just talked about during these brief phone calls. I really recommend that you take a look at them. If you would like to get on that PLC list, go ahead and send me an email to hkballou@eicc.edu. Again, that's hkballou@eicc.edu. Just send me an email and we'll get you guys on the list.
Great. Any other questions or comments? We'll let everyone get back to their day. If not, anything, something comes up, just drop us a note or respond to the notes.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks, everybody. And we'll the last PLC in this cohort will be 2 weeks from now, same time, same place, same call-in on the 16th of December, and then we'll be taking a little bit of a holiday break. So we'll talk to you all then.
Stay safe. Stay healthy. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye.